Like, quick skinner. My name is Alexandre Nicuado. I'm here with my colleague André Zdomen, and this week we have Martin Love as guest. So, Martin, if you introduce yourself.
Okay. Hey, guego es agua guego. Agora noro no waxanoda ne ganya kahaga na jatodo. Kohiga diskana zawa guego. So, greetings everyone. My name is Martin Love. Martin agora noro Love. I'm a visual artist from Ganoage. Glad to be here. Glad to be invited to talk with you, André. I've talked to you many times before, and your art, your audience out there. Really pleased to be able to chime in and give my two cents on, I guess, my career as an artist and the things that I've seen in Montreal over, you know, the last almost 40 years now. I mean, it was the first show that I was in 85 in the city, and so glad to see things, you know, really progress and change, and mostly for the better. So greetings, everyone.
Welcome on the Azadegan Street. This is one of the positive change we had in this city, this new name in the topography, toponymy of Montreal. So, and a Mohawk name. So yes. This is really pleasant to now exchange with under this umbrella. I notice also that your Mohawk name is Akwaranoran.
That's
and
it.
I was wondering what was the meaning of this name.
It means a precious tree. Precious? Like, I guess a precious, you know, like a precious tree. And my mother used to say I was an expensive tree. Anyway, it's a joke. It's a joke. But is the street that your office is on actually on Azadegan Street?
No. Oh. We gave the name of the podcast when we were looking for a name. We wanted something typical of Montreal, but also something that would be a reference to the indigenous heritage of the city. And of course, Rue Azadegan, it was interesting because this is also obviously something that is rooted with the most ancient traditions of the territory, but at the same time, which that is really symbolic of the change, the positive change that we had known in the last maybe 10, 15 years. Yes. So that was, but we are on the Gaspé Street, which is the Gaspé come from Gaspé, which is also indigenous language origin. I think it is Mi'kmaq, and it means where the water is narrower, where the water is narrow. This was the name, of course, in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, the name of the place named Gaspé, because you, from the deep sea, you arrive in the delta where the shores are of the St. Lawrence enclose, in a sense, the waters.
Yeah. The name of the show, Rue Azadegan, is very apropos. It's very meaningful in a sense too, because what they say at beginning of gatherings, of meetings, you know, sometime a speaker will stand up and get people's attention. And what they say is, how the Azadegan. So it gets everybody's attention. And it's like, you know, like you begin to think like brothers and sisters, then you go into your thing, you know? So it's,
okay.
It's very interesting. Or my relatives, you know? So I like the name and I like the word. I remember some elders that I think fondly of would start like that with a stick, you know, they hit the stick on the floor and they say, how, go with the dega. Everybody looks. All right, now we're going to start. So it's wonderful.
Okay. Repeat it again.
They say, how, the what the dega.
What the dega.
Exactly. There what the dega.
There what the dega.
The what the dega, yeah. And it's
like, what the dega.
It's similar to saying like attention. Brothers and sisters.
Okay. Well, I will remember this one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
We could begin now our podcast with...
Yeah, because usually at a meeting or at a thing, people are chatting, they're meeting people and everything. And now you got to start, you got to get people's attention. So it's a good name for the street and it's a good name for your show too. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And it's interesting. We will come back to the Mohawk language and how all the efforts that are done in Ganawagi, your home place, where the there is, and you have been part of it, of course, of the preservation and the development of the language. But first of all, we will speak of your artist works. We were so proud that it was really beautiful to have all the portraits you have made during the years with indigenous leaders and figures of our, I would say, communities, and with an S, because there is people from all around the place, from Ganawagi, but also of other origin living in Montreal and being part of the living indigenous community that is now taking place in Montreal. And wow, and it is also historical, because some of this photo will stay with us forever as a testimony of what we were. And wow, that was really an experience. And I remember somewhere you told that this is your iron worker brother that somehow bring you a camera. I am right?
Yeah, close. Yeah, I think as a youth, you know, and I always say this to my own children and other young people as well, you know, you never know what is like the beginning, you know, of something, the nucleus, you know, the spark that kind of like sends you off in any one direction. And I remember as a kid, I mean, most people have photo albums at home, and we used to have them on the refrigerator, just like everybody else, family photos of our ancestors, our relatives, and, you know, baby pictures and whatnot. But we didn't really have a camera ourselves. You know, I mean, I didn't. Occasionally my sister would show up with a camera. And one year, my brother he's a retired iron worker now, but he boomed out. He worked in New York City and in Florida and Texas and many places. And everybody in Ganawagi, young men for sure, 90% of them, the high 90s, wanted to grow up and become an iron worker. You know, we wanted to get our iron worker book, our boots, our belt with all our tools, and then go with the men off to work, you know, in big cities and so on, to leave the reserve and come home with stories, come home with lots of money and a new car. And, you know, you could boast, you know, that you built this bridge or that building and so on. And it was part of, and it is still really part of the culture and part of the tradition, and people hold it in high regard. And one year my brother came back with a stack of pictures and stories and this camera. And the camera, you know, was like, it had all the buttons, all the knobs and all the things. And as, you know, a 16-year-old, 17-year-old, it's like, oh my God, I want something. I want part of that. And I went out and I found one. I was out in Lachine, which is across the river from Ganawagi. You could see the shoreline of Montreal across the St. Lawrence and Lachine, and in a shopping district that was at one time like our main street shopping area for the community. Before the Mercier Bridge, there used to be ferry boats that would bring people from the community, and there were little water taxis that would bring people across the river to Lachine and so on and do their shopping. And at the center of it, there was a store, a camera store called C.A. Barbier. And he was the camera guy, the photographer who photographed in the community. He photographed weddings. He photographed first communions. He photographed events. And believe it or not, he even photographed funerals. Occasionally, people would call him to do a photograph of their deceased. But he had a wonderful camera shop, and I happened to be, and there used to be a bus even that drove into the community, into Lachine, and parked on 6th Avenue in Notre Dame, in Notre Dame, in Lachine. And his shop was there, and I happened to walk past, and in the window, there was a camera, and it had a $50 price tag, and I said, whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to go and I'm going to buy that camera. And I bought it, and I got my first lesson in the store counter, and you put the film in, and I was off. I walked to the river. I I walked over the train bridge into the community, and I've been basically taking photographs ever since. And I slowed down occasionally. I stopped. I pivoted to different media as a printmaker and a silversmith. And I did a little bit of theater in the past, you know. So, I mean, I think it was the spark, the creative spark that kind of sent me in the trajectory of life that I've kind of like lived for all these years. And, you know, it's been an adventure and been wonderful.
And how come you didn't became iron worker?
Well, I did my best. I saved, because at that time you could, I think now you have to go to a school. There are a couple schools in the US and in Canada. Montreal's got one where you have to go in, and because of all of the safety regulations and so on, you actually have to take a course. You know, you have to learn all the safety. You have to learn, you know, all the job, basically, like becoming a carpenter, let's say, you know. But back then, you could just basically hang on to a relative, and they would bring you onto the job, and you would learn on the job. And they actually, believe it or not, they call them punks. When you start, you're a punk. you're like an apprentice, basically. So I tried, and I saved my money, and I did all of the, you know, kind of like, come on, let me go. I mean, anyway, in the end, I didn't get taken on as a punk, as an apprentice, because you need someone, because it's highly unionized. So you have to have a relative. You have to have someone who could vouch for you and bring you through. And I guess be responsible for you too. You know, you have to be responsible if you were to get hurt. If you were to goof off, if you were to, you know, not show up for work kind of deal, you have someone close to you that could set you straight. So I never did become an iron worker. I went to school instead. I went to Dawson College, CEGEP, and I studied filmmaking and photography and visual arts. And then at Concordia, I did the same thing. I studied photography with a number of, you know, well-known Montreal and Canadian photographers and so on at the time. Many of them, I notice on Facebook, they're not Instagram famous, but, you know, they've been doing their work for many years quietly in the backgrounds and so on. And, you know, that's the direction that I went in. And after I studied, I got a job at the Cultural Center of Ganawage, and I put in close to 30 years over there working in their photo archives. We looked after our old photos. And then over the years, I ended up being the public program supervisor. So we did all of the, we worked with you, of course, for the festival many years, and our workshops and our symposiums and artist talks and artist author book launches. And we everything. We did our filmmaking workshops as well back in the day. So, you know, they all kind of like, you know, as I think as a person, you kind of like, you just go off and do your thing over the years. And, you know, and when I started, I imagined myself, you know, being a National Geographic photographer, being a photojournalist that went to all the, you know, you imagine. But I think sometimes when you work close to community, you know, I mean, it has a lasting effect, you know, that people see you in the community. You know, I do some work with the Eastern Door newspaper, for instance, you know, where I get my photos and photography and articles occasionally published in there. So, you know, if you work in community, it's like a small world, but I think it speaks to a larger world, you know, like, you know, and the young people who are coming up today, you know, I think, you know, they see people like us, old people, you know, doing things and producing, and, you know, gives them the, I guess, the urge as well to go out and do things in the world. But I never did become an iron worker. And do I regret it? Maybe a little bit. It would have been fun. I know some people who are artists as well, you know, who got, actually there's quite a few actually iron workers who became artists, you know, like they got hurt on the job and they had 6 months or a year to recuperate. And while they were recuperating, they started drawing. You know, they never realized they could draw. They started carving. They never realized they could carve, you know, and then, you know, it becomes part of the tradition. And like anything, I think an occupation doesn't necessarily mean you're not an artist. You know, you could be a shoemaker and be a great poet, you know, or a photographer or a painter and so on, you know. So, you know, these things, I'd say that, you know, they have to be suited to you. You have to be suited to it. Like art too. You know, you have to be suited to whatever you do. If you may not be suited to become a, you know, watercolorist. You know, you may be more of a printmaker, you know, carving wooden plates or metal or etching plates or, you know, getting pottery. You know, really, it's I think your journey, you know, as a person and as an artist.
That's like, I'm wondering, in Garawagi, there's, I guess, there's some needs that the students wants to go. As I was growing up, people told me that I need to be an accountant, or I need to go to administration, everything that the reserves needs, Manwan needs. But I didn't see myself in those jobs. So yeah. I never knew what I wanted to do growing up.
Yeah, that is.
Is it the same in Garawagi?
Absolutely. I know that, you know, and I've heard it among other artists as well, you know, that I wouldn't say it's discouraged, but it isn't like it's an encouraged. It is encouraged, but it isn't. It is and it isn't, you know, because I think sometimes the real needs of a community, you know, are like, we really need this. So therefore, we're going to put our money, you know, our funding, our efforts, you know, to get an Indigenous doctor. You are an Indigenous engineer or a water specialist, you know, or environment specialist. I completely see that. But, you know, art, I think sometimes will make you a better engineer. You know, it'll make you a better scientist. It'll make you, you know, a better public speaker. If you do performance or you do theater, you know, you can get your point across. So art, I think, you know, for me anyway, and I'm talking to artists, right? So you're going to agree with me. I'm sure if I was sitting on a panel with scientists, you know, whatever, I know you got to be a strict scientist. But I feel, you know, that at the heart of so many professions, creativity is there, you know, and if you could teach yourself and have a creative mind, you know, you can also have creative solutions, you know, in any of those fields, you know, and that's just the way it is. You know, I only wish that, I know, like, say, for instance, when our own survival school started, and not to complain about the survival school, and I don't know if anybody from survival school is listening right now, but anyhow, you know, they had things, they had agriculture, you know, they had animal husbandry, they had silversmithing, they had leather, where they had all of these kind of topics in their schools, you know, that, you know, today they don't exist in real sense. You know, they don't have, you know, someone teaching the young people to tan hides, to make leather, to do pottery, to do all of these things. And I would only wish that, you know, someone would take that on, you know, because it is part of the heritage, the patrimony, you know. I spoke to years ago, I spoke to, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, if you know more, at Vieux Montréal, they have so what's called a patrimonial arts like CEGEP stream that people can go into, you know, where they study the traditional arts of Quebec, you know, like glass making and pottery and wood carving. And there's, you know, there should be more of an appreciation, you know, and schools should probably look into stuff like that. But I know what you mean, that, you know, the arts, even though people love it, even though people, you know, kind of support it to a sense, I think, you know, I don't think you're going to run into too many people who are going to say, well, I convinced my son not to become a doctor. You know, I said, go make art, go be a spray paint artist, you know. But I think young people, it's like, and I've said that to young people as well as myself. I've worked with some youths in workshops and sort of stuff. It's like, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, it's like a calling. You have to do it. You know, if you feel the need to go out and be an artist, to be a filmmaker, photographer, to be in that field, you know, it's kind of like no one's going to convince you otherwise. You know, you're going to do it, you know, and if great riches come, you know, I guess that's a good thing. If none of it comes and you just, you know, live a creative life and you make a contribution here and there, I think that's valid. That's just as good.
And I suppose to be an artist also is a long journey. And when you are with your family at Christmas, you have a lot of stories to tell too.
Yeah.
And also, I remember when we met, long time ago. For the first time, you were at the cultural center, but at this time, the indigenous arts didn't get the recognition they we see now. It was really snubbed by the most of the artistic milieu of Montreal or Toronto. It was not seen as a part of real contemporary art. And also, the effort has been made from several artists from Ganawagi to change things. We had Skawenati in this podcast last week or the week before. And I remember Ryan Reyes, that has been as commissaire d'exposition, a real a person that really brought some change around. And you were there at this time. You have seen this turning point also.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed that show, by the way. I was downtown, actually, and it popped up. Hey, they're going live. So I went live, and Skowenati's talk with you was wonderful. I really enjoyed that, for sure. And of course, she was there at the beginning of, I guess, like the turning point, you know, when art started to change. Another one that gets, I guess, not as much, I guess, notice is Dana Williams. Dana Williams is a painter, was a Anishinaabe Potawatomi artist in the city, and he worked at the Native Friendship Center.
The painting behind is Dana Williams.
Is it Dana Williams? Oh, very cool, very cool, very cool. In 1985, he organized with a group at UCAM an Indigenous art exhibition. It was me and Gunna Matouche, Steve McCumber, Pauline Lahesh, Domingo Cisneros, Dana, Pierre Seewee, was a whole crew of artists that were working in the city. And
all around the city, because there was so many artists. It was called New Territories. And there was so many artists that they couldn't put it in one venue. So it was spread all over the city, and it was really, now we have the BACA, the Biennale of, but this was the very first big move to have indigenous artists to be recognized in established venues all around the city. Dana was there, obviously.
Yeah. So he organized it. And like I said, two years in a row, I think afterwards, they did an international one. They sent it to Latin America, to Mexico, and in a number of other countries. And it was really the beginning of something. And at the time, I, of course, like everyone else, I thought like we're on the beginning of something, you know, that's going to explode. And sadly, it kind of slumped, you know, once again. And then Ryan and his crew, that people who were studying at Concordia, they really, you know, went beyond, I think, what I think any of us imagined. And today, you know, I think it's really gratifying to see so many young artists and people who are working within, you know, the academy, you know, in universities and in art galleries. And it's really become, you know, a hub for even like the rest of Canada and even in the U.S. as well and around the world. Indigenous people are really, you know, it's like a crossroads, you know. Montreal is becoming, you know, that kind of a thing again, you know, that I guess kind of creates that synergy, they call it, you know, when there's enough people with creativity and with experience, you know, that it can kind of like, you know, turn into something. Because, you know, it really... You know, it really is about time for everybody, you know, to get their day in the sun, their recognition. And, you know, it happens in practically every other city in Canada, and then even in the U.S. and around, that, you know, people are out there doing things, and, you know, there's an audience for it, whether it's theater or visual arts, you know, radio and film and so on. It's really, and of course, Terres en Vue and Présence Autochtone, I think, is right there along with everything, you know, that is really pushing that, the envelope, and then moving that story through to, you know, to the future. And the future is bright.
So it's not always been an easy path, but we did it together. And I think we can collectively really be proud of all the great pace forward we have made. And we're referring to Ganawagi, but Ganawagi is very connected to the world. I remember you brought an exhibition that was first on Bowling Green at the museum in New York City. And you brought it to Ganawagi. It was right after the plane crash in the World Center.
Yeah.
And the Ganawagi Huron workers went to help.
Yeah.
After the catastrophe. And there was this fantastic exhibition that was about how the connection between the building, the builders, the Mohawk builders, the city of New York, and the link with Ganawagi. And I know how you were very happy to have the possibility of having all these exhibits in the cultural center of Ganawagi.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The National Museum of the American Indian, that's the Smithsonian's national, their museum, worked with our community there was a major exhibition in Washington that was presented on the community. Can you hear me? All of a sudden, I'm going, oh there
yes,
it is.
Yes,
okay, no problem. Okay. So they did the research for over, I think, 3 to 4 years and so on. And then while they were doing it, the people of New York, you know, really, and all of the mayor and whatever, learned of the story of the Mohawk iron workers. I mean, it's a relatively well-known story in New York City. And we created together with them an exhibit called Booming Out. It opened in New York City, was there for several months. And then one of their stipulations was that they would share it. And there, you know, many of the museums try to do this now, to share the research and then the materials with the community. So we moved that whole exhibit into it was in the Case Populaire building, the community services building. And it was really quite beautiful. And I think for the family, the iron workers themselves, and then for their families, I think it had a ripple effect, you know, where people, you know, appreciate, you know, the work that people did and the stories that came from it, not only like because of the World Trade Center attack, but also the whole story of iron workers and how they left community of Ganawagi. One of the first big jobs, of course, was the Quebec Bridge in 1907. That was known as the Quebec Bridge disaster. 33 people in the community died, which was an international event as well. And then eyes were on the community for iron work. And the World Trade Center thing, of course, was another thing, you know, that people in Ganawagi worked from the very first piers that were put up of the World Trade Center to the very top of the building. And then after both towers were put up, they extended it another, I think it was 200 feet of communications tower. And believe it or not, there were Mohawks at the very end of that job as well, you know. And then, of course, when the World Trade Center was attacked and so on, there were several hundred Mohawks from Ganawagi, from Akwesasne, from Six Nations working around in Manhattan and in Brooklyn and in New Jersey. And there's some incredible stories that have been told that I'm pretty sure they have them logged at the archive at the Cultural Center at the library. But if you've seen any horror movies, you know, when they're disaster, people are fleeing, you know, like over the bridges, on the water, you know, getting out of harm's way. And to think, you know, that there were iron workers, Mohawk iron workers in Ganawagi, who were working in New Jersey across the river, who were like the salmon fighting to get into the city because they knew that their skills would be put to use. And one of the stories that I was told, I was there like a week after the thing. And actually we got a tour of the site and so on by the New York City Police Department. And they said that one of the reasons they got on was that because usually in these cases, it would be the firemen themselves who would be cutting and doing all these things. And they're specially trained firemen who have experience working with structural damage and so on, you know, because it could all fall on you and so on. But many of them had died in the attack. So they needed these people. And there must have been, I would say, maybe 30 to 40 Mohawks and Ranawaga, Akwesasne, Six Nations working at that site, helping, you know, find the remains. And I don't think anybody was. It was really basically a recovery operation afterwards. And sadly, you know, the sad story is that many of them became ill afterwards. And there have been a number of unusual cases of cancer and people who've died. And, you know, their own struggle to get recognition and to get compensation is also a story for sure. But
they became ill from what?
From the fumes, because it was everything from asbestos to cyanide to all of the everything that fell into and then incinerated. So you had all this toxic dust.
Oh, yeah.
When I was there, I remember it was like, I don't know if you've ever sniffed ammonia. Did you ever sniff?
Yes,
like,
yes.
You have no way other than to go, whoa, you know, like it's like it hits you like a power. You can't. So I remember walking into the pit where everything was going on, and you get to a certain point and you would hit like a pit, a fumes, you know, that would just throw you back. And they just had masks, they had towels, they had different things going in. And, you know, it was quite a time for sure.
Yeah, even centuries ago, Ganawagi was an international place because the French Mohawks of the South Shore, they were during the Régime Français, they were the one trading, well, it was contraband in the in the eyes of the French colonists, but it was a way to keep alive the French colony because a lot of goods were missing in the colony of Montreal, and the Mohawks took the furs that were arriving in Montreal to trade with Albany and came back with sugar, salt, spoons, all small and great ingredients that was needed to live. And the French at the time had not the fleet that to keep the colony with enough goods arriving. And of course, the Englishes were seamen, and also at the period we I remember in 2001 we commemorated the Great Peace of Montreal, and the Cultural Center was a part of it. And reading the history of that time, all the indigenous delegations from all over America, before coming to Montreal to meet the French governor, they were stopping at Ganawagi. It was part of the protocol. Yep. So we can see that this small community has incredible, at least continental-wide, if not worldwide, connection. It's very unique, I think, in all the indigenous communities of America.
And in during the French regime or whatever, you know, there were the so-called the Christian or the Catholic communities right along the St. Lawrence and so on. And it was known as the Seven Nations of Canada, and there were indigenous nations, and Ganawagi was the capital, you know, so that all of the people from, you know, from Wendake, from the Mi'kmaq, the people who were Catholic would meet in Ganawagi. Even in Maine and Massachusetts, there are Maliseet people and so on that would come to Ganawagi, and that's exactly what they would. It would be like the capital town of the principal town of the Seven Nations, for sure. Absolutely. I just want to say too that what we used to say, we used to tell people the business of, you know, the illegal trade or the contraband trade and so on. You know, the furs would come up the St. Lawrence, and the people would meet in Ganawagi, and they would do that. They would barter, they would trade. There were several families. I think there were sisters called the Desaunier sisters, had a trading post and so on. And she worked with the people in the community, and they had a regular route up the Richelieu River down into Vermont and so on, and into Albany. And one of the things that and it always it makes me laugh, but it's the British were known for wool. So they had wonderful, like high-tech socks, you know, made of the best woolen socks. They had for shawls, you know, they had beautiful wool, like the Hudson Bay blankets, you know, that were, and if you figure, like we live in Canada, right? So 40 degrees, 50 degrees, if you have good socks, if you have a good blanket, you know, that is worth it. And what it is they say that it is a time saver. So if you have to clothe 50 people, you know, imagine all the furs you have to process, all the furs you have to tan, whatever it is. And then for some beaver, you get a blanket, you know, you get socks, you get, you know, things that will keep you warm, keep the children warm, keep the old people warm, everybody. So for sure. And one of the things they used to say is, and there's some, I don't have footnotes here, but apparently there were people in Montreal, well-off people and people in the area and around Ganawage, French Canadians and Canadians, who would basically put in orders. You know, we want so many blankets. We want so many socks. And they would be able to get these things trade. And then, you know, so I would say like Ganawage for sure has been involved in the economic life of this region as well, you know, through the fur trade, through, you know, the bridges that were built, you know, the CPR bridge that connects Montreal to the South Shore and then on to markets in the US, the Lachine Canal, you know, that people in Ganawage worked on the Lachine Canal. Many of the stones to build the Lachine Canal were quarried in Ganawage and transported to the site by our people, you know. So it's really, you know, we're really very involved in many of these things. And, you know, that's our tradition, that's our heritage, it's our history.
And going back to your artworks, sure. How have you come to make prints? Because you were at the beginning mainly photographer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, so I started out as a photographer. I did a number of projects and so on, and I exhibited them nationally and some internationally and so on. And I had an interest in prints, because prints is, and photography is, it's not a precious, unique thing, you know, in the sense like a painting is, you make a painting and that's what it is. It's one, you know, or a sculpture, you make one. With photography, you make it in multiple, you know, so you can make many copies, and your audience before Instagram, before online distribution, you know, you're able to get it out to people. And that is the, like the nature of photography. And then printmaking is a similar thing where you make your original matrix, you know, that is art, and then you make them in multiple. So you can make copies so that, you know, it has a wider audience and, you know, more people get to see it. And it's also for photography and film, it's a hands-on, you know, that you actually have to mix inks. You have to, you know, put them onto screens or onto plates, and you have to print them, you know, you have to produce them. And it's a kind of like, it's an analog way of working. And we used to say before digital came along, you know, photography was that way as well. You know, you had to, you know, take your hands and you had to produce something from basically nothing. You know, you have the technology, but, you know, you're basically baking it with your hands. And, you know, printmaking is a very deliberate art form, you know, that you have to, I mean, some people can be very spontaneous, you know, and make monoprints and so on. But the idea with printmaking is you make a master matrix, and then you make the print, you make the images in multiple, trying to, you know, replicate your artist proof, your main, you know, the proof that you've taken time to develop and to make into a fine art piece, you know. But it is, you know, and but with printmaking, I've always tried to weave in photography. So I use photos to compose the images. I use photos in the images sometimes, and then print them. You know, so it's something that I enjoy, and you know, it's something that keeps me interested. If I lost interest, I'd go to do something else. And I did actually. I did silversmithing for a while. I learned with Raymond Gabriel, the late Ganadaze from Ganasadage. I was just talking to him today, about him today, to another silversmith, Leo Diabo Ganawage. Both of them were very fine silversmiths. So I did that for a while. I made, you know, earrings and brooches and pins and headdresses and so on. I did crafts for a while. I made costoas. I've got some in collections at the university, at the Museum of Civilization in Quebec City, and at the Deerfield Museum in the United States, in Massachusetts, and so on. You know, so I've kind of like I've gone in different directions that time. But you know, as an artist, I think sometimes you need to take a break. You know, and you need to go and shift gears and do something else. And then, you know, you always come back to, you know, the things that, you know, settle you. And in photography, for me, you know, has been a settling effect. And I would say, you know, during the pandemic, we used to go for walks, you know, we used to go for like 5 kilometer walks a day, 10 kilometer walks. We did 2 half marathons, you know, like 23 kilometers. Took about 4.5 hours. So as I was walking and we were walking, you tell stories, you know, like, oh, you know, when I was a kid, this and that. And then I remembered when I was, we were walking and I recalled, it's a genre of photography called street photography. So it's basically like, in a sense, like urban social documentary photography. So the idea is your environment, you know, where you are and the things that you see and so on. And I used to do that as a young person. I used to walk from my apartment in St. Henry up to Westmount, all the way to St. Lawrence, St. Laurent, all the way to the Metropolitan and back. And I would just be like someone observing the world, you know, taking pictures and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, seeing the pictures that I enjoyed that resonated with me, and then I would print them. And those were some of the things that really brought me a lot of joy. And during the pandemic, of course, I had my iPhone and I said, I got to get back to doing this. I used to really enjoy this. So I went out and I got a new mirrorless camera and I'm out photographing. And it really is like, in a sense, like reliving my youth, you know, like I remember the feeling of trying to make art basically out of nothing. You know, you go out and you try to capture spontaneous moments sometimes in the street, you know, and it's really interesting. And it's a way too, like you have to put on a little hat, you know, like your way of thinking and everything. And, you know, I think about, you know, the paths that we take, you know, in life, you know, as Indigenous people, sometimes most often we are ignored sometimes, or we're like in the shadows, you know, like we show up every now and then, and every now and then, you know, at big manifestations, you know, like the Truth and Reconciliation Day or in protests, you know, we show up and we are present, or at festivals, we're present, you know, but every day there are people living in the city from different nations walking around and doing their same thing. And in a sense, it's like capturing it, preserving it, you know, making a moment of it to say, you know, we were here, we saw this, or at least I did, and this is, you know, my little contribution to the world. And what I've noticed online, I belong to many Facebook groups and Instagram feeds and so on. In Montreal today, there's probably, I would say, maybe 30 to 40 people who are doing the same thing as I'm doing. You know, so you see their work and so on. And because I'm Indigenous and I include Indigenous images, sometimes it's like, oh, I didn't know that was in Montreal. I didn't know, you know, that Ganawaga is so close, you know. I didn't know these things happened. And, you know, it's a way for me to share and to learn and so on. And I've noticed that in many other cities in North America, actually in the world, there are people who are doing similar things. And what's interesting is, you know, with social media, I guess everybody does social media. I don't know if Andre, I don't know if you're on social media, but so you're the only one.
It's so dangerous for him to be on social media.
Yeah. Well, I've been on social media for about 8 years, 9 years. That's 10 years shorter than my children. My children go back 20 years, you know, like whatever, and my wife and so on. So anyway, I got on there, and it really is a platform that we never would have had before, you know, that you can make art, you can make things, and you can join in a global conversation, you know, with people who are doing similar work, you know. And people say, oh, I didn't know Montreal had so many, you know, documentary street photographers and really happy. And again, too, that social media, you know, people say, I'm going to quit social media. And to be honest, you know, that has been a platform that I've gotten so many, basically like gigs, you know, like exhibitions or invitations to be part of things and so on. And most recently, the McCord Museum is doing an exhibition. It's going to be in the spring of 2025. And it is basically like Montreal street photography or social documentary photography, I guess, from the past 100 years or so. I don't know if you've seen the exhibitions that are on St. Laurent on St. Catherine Street. They have little kiosks and they have like that corner in 1935, this corner in 1955, you know, and there are people coming and going, taking pictures and preserving it for the future. And my work showed up in the mix, and I got a message from one of the curators, and she asked me if, you know, I would submit some work and talk with her and so on like that. So in a sense, you know, there are, you know, Indigenous street photographers walking around doing something similar. So, yeah.
Is it this one?
This is one of the panels from the exhibition that was this summer, the Art Urbain de Montréal that was spread throughout the city. Yeah. So these are here's some of my street photography. And I also do portraits. I do a whole bunch of things. I'm a multidisciplinary. We're working on an exhibition. I do sports as well, kickboxing and so on. If you go to the one of the corn, there's one. What was it? Here it is. That one. Yeah, there might be others. There's others as well.
Mm.
Well, so here we go. So this one, there was a curator from the Missouri Botanical Gardens in Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri. She was looking for images, documentary images of people and traditional corn production. And so she asked me to submit some stuff. And I have this work that I did with the community garden. There's a movement in the community to reincorporate traditional foods and the knowledge that is around it of growing corn and making our own cornbread and cornmeal and corn soup and all of these things. So that is an exhibition that is going to be in Missouri in May. They're having a ethnobotany conference, and the museum at the Botanical Gardens is doing a whole display of indigenous food uses and the technologies that are around them.
Hmm.
What else have I got going? Right now we have an exhibition at the Wandat Museum at the Nage. That's the Guayadunk Literary Festival. Louis Carl, I believe, was one of the curators. It's been going around Quebec in the last while, different cultural centers. And then I believe in the fall it's going to be going, it's in Wandage right now, and in the fall it's going to New Brunswick. So I did a piece for them based on a literary text. So it was more like photography and screen printing and carving and so on. And I'm also working with Mike Patton, who's there it is, the legacy. Yeah, that is there. I'm working with Mike Patton, who's, I believe it's part of the Biennale that is for November. We're putting together a show at U of M. And it'll be a collection of photos and prints and a digital slide presentation as well that'll be in the works. Yeah. And I can't go without thanking Mylène Gay over at the Arts Council of Montreal. They were able to give me some funding to do some of the work that I've been doing in the last year and presenting it, you know, at the festival and in virtually and in gallery settings. So for me, I think it's really coming along, and I'm happy to still be doing it after all these years. Yeah.
And maybe for to finish this conversation, I would like us to speak a bit about the Mohawk language and the you were at the cultural center when the focus has been made on the transmission of the language. It became the one of the main purpose of the center. And you were also someone who wanted to learn deeper the language. And I know you put a lot of time and effort on it. And how do you see the situation?
Oh, man, it's amazing. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just to see young people speaking, you know, speaking to elders and laughing and joking and, you know, really carrying on, you know, more than what I can do is a few phrases here and there. And it's like funny, you know, I'm sure they consider it funny. Oh, he can say a few phrases. He can answer a question. But to be able to talk about, you know, meaningful things in the language is at a higher level than what I ever achieved. And I've witnessed it myself, you know, like young people just going to it, you know, that Kahnawake was one of the early adopters of immersion for children, you know, so like kindergarten children, grade one, all the way to grade six and so on. And it did a lot. It really improved the, you know, the footing for the foundation for language. And what they noticed over the years is that once people then go on to high school, if it's going to be in the city or even in the community, you know, they then use English as a subject, you know, so I mean English, Mohawk as a subject, not as a teaching. You know, you don't learn in high school math in Mohawk. You don't learn social studies in Mohawk. So it really, they went up and then they kind of plateaued. And so the cultural center responded to a call in the community because we had elderly language teachers who were ready to retire. And they said, you know, like in 5 years, the majority of the teachers will be retiring and who's going to replace them? So the cultural center at that time took up the cause basically and said, well, we will start something to take many of those young people who had been through immersion, who had a strong basis, or young people who are people basically who could kind of like were at a lower level or at a certain level of language and bring them to a higher level. And that's exactly what they did. You know, they got people in, and now the schools are full of people who graduated from this adult immersion. And when I did it for a year, but it was really more like 10 months. And then the year after I left, they made it a 2-year program. So you have to commit to a 2-year immersion program, and you know you take the course, and by the end of it, you are on your way to becoming, you know, a higher level speaker. And like I said, I've seen some young people doing just that, and it's truly truly amazing.
And is it open to anyone or just for the Mohawk people?
Well, yeah, exactly. They have a criteria, so I think they even have a thing where they you get a certain point. I could be wrong for saying that you are going to use it in the schools, that you may become a teacher, you know, because it's like a limited, to me, I'd say it's a limited resource, you know, that they have and a little window there, and that, you know, people should go into the community. And some have gone into it and said, well, I want to go and be on the radio, you know, be a radio and I'm going to include my language in the radio, or I want to do this and environment and I want to use it in the language. I want to be at the bank, you know, and I want to be able to service our elders in the language, you know, so, you know, they have a certain kind of like a criterion, let's say. And I think you get certain points for, you know, kind of dedicating yourself to using it in the community and to further, you know, a community objective.
I remember in Kahnawake you had so great ideas and great activity. Of course, Marion de la Ronde puppet shows in Mohawk. That's really fantastic. That's an extraordinary experience. And I remember you told me that you were at the photo preservation at the archives in Kahnawake. And you have put a slideshow that elders were commentating in Mohawk. Yeah. And you put it on the cable TV channel, asking people when they were not listening to TV to put that channel on. And of course, with the sound, so the children could listen to Mohawk in their realm. That was so great as an idea, simple, but at the same time, very, very intelligent. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that they have said, you know, is that like, say for myself too, I don't understand the language like 100%. I learn, you know, a bit, but I remember as a child hearing it, you know, like my parents and my father, my uncles, my aunts and neighbors and so on, you know, so I understand the music of it, you know, the cadence of it, you know, the way, you know, like you can almost anticipate laughter, you know, you can really kind of deal. And so what I've been told when we started that whole thing was that there are some people who just played it in the background, you know, like music, you know, so they could listen to it. And they were saying, this one was saying, I want to send my children to immersion. So every night when they go to bed, I play it lowly on a low level, you know, so that they hear the words, they hear the, you know, they hear these things. So it's not like listening to a language they never heard before, you know, so it really kind of like acclimatizes them to listening to the language. And then, you know, someone said, well, it's like jazz, you know, jazz, you don't necessarily, you know, you listen through your ears, but you just absorb it, you know. And I think sometimes, you know, language is that way, that it's like something that is just like an immersive situation. You know, you have to be able to, you know, take it in. But, you know, the kind of like solid curriculum and all of those things are important too. And they have that as well. The people in Ganawage have got, you know, 40 years of experience creating curriculum in the language and books and readers. And, you know, the cultural center, I know, became like, it was like an addition to all of the things that were going on. And I think that's the kind of the philosophy that the community takes, basically, is that everybody has a role, everybody contributes. And, you know, so what if four people are doing the same thing? You know, as long as they're pushing in the same direction, everything is, you know, everything is going to be good in the end. And it helps everybody.
Well, we could go on for another 1 hour, but I think for today, this is the time we got. We will have to invite you again, because we have not covered all the subjects, obviously. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that we could do a special episode during the festival.
Sure.
If you're still here.
Sure. Well, Andre, am I still there? I think it's three years now, I think. So anyway, I enjoy that. I really enjoy doing the festival. I really like to meet a lot of people. And, you know, I try to use as much French as I can. And it's a struggle. But, you know, I try to do as much as I can. I enjoy the people. And it's all, you know, not necessarily people who are there for the festival sometimes. Sometimes they're just like people who are like, what's going on here? You know, and that's also very nice, you know, and the Americans. I like running into, you know, Americans that come to the festival. And I particularly like the African Americans that are in the area. And I always have excellent conversations, because I think sometimes we forget our struggles are so similar, you know, like it's quite phenomenal, actually. I enjoy that. But your whole, the setup where you are right in the center of all the action, you know, really is, it does me good. And I'm sure it helps a lot of the people who are looking for, you know, some representation of indigenous people in the city.
Yes, and we are really, we really want to keep this connection with Ganawage. It's essential for us, with Redir, with Sedalia Fadzio, with you, with all the elders and the younger of the community.
And the festival that you the work that you do in the community as well is like, you know, I mean, to have our own filmmakers who've gone out into the world be able to present to the community within a larger festival, you know, to have, you know, people, experienced filmmakers come into the community, it creates a whole like a buzz and excitement. And, you know, it's like a wonderful part of the festival. And over the years, I've always enjoyed working with you and working with the community to do some of these things.
And it's not finished. We will go on that.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. It's like it's literally like a bridge. You know, it's like a bridge to our community, and then back and forth we can do these things, because it is also so close. You know, like we're so close to the city, but in our own little bubble. We're in our own little bubble in Ganawage, for sure.
But now I was on this last fall with TV crew from France. They were doing a report on indigenous cultures and realities in Quebec. And we were on the Mont-Royal, and I was looking. We were on the Belvedere Gondiaronk. Well, there is a Huron name for one of the most famous places in Montreal. And then I looked, the flag of Montreal was there. And now we have the great pine, the symbol of the great law of peace in the middle of the flag of Montreal. And I said, wow, I was part of all this. We were part of all this re-immersion of the re-inscription of the what is has always been part of the soul of the place. And now we can see it and show it to visitors. That's really great. And wow, you were speaking how with a creative life, we can be happy. And I know I have been very privileged to have also creative life, being a kind of walking on the bridge between Montreal and Ganawagi and all the great Haudenosaunee tradition.
And everybody that I talk to, like I have friends in throughout Canada and the U.S., you know, you mention, you know, a festival, an Indigenous festival in Montreal. It's like, I want to go. How can I come? And well, send Andre a proposal. You know, there you go. But it's really, you know, it's an exciting time. And, you know, the city for sure has come around as well, you know, with arts funding for Indigenous artists as well. And, you know, the new Daphne Gallery and so on.
Yeah.
And
Daphne Art Center is just our neighbor. They are on the Upper Street at almost the same address. Then.
So I was just there for the Nuit Blanche. I did an event over there, printmaking event. And I told them, and we were talking after everybody left, they got 500 people to go in one night for Nuit Blanche. It was like I was in the metro, you know, when they let the show out, you know, it's like, holy, all these people. But I said, you know, now we got to work on put it in the ear of whatever, that Montreal needs at least one Maison de Culture Autochtone. we need one. All we want is one. Who knows? Eventually, hopefully.
Yeah, this is the wish.
I'm not alone.
Yeah, we will express, and we will meet again, obviously, for a new artistic experience and to establish more solidly the expression of indigenous cultures in the city and all around.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Alexandre, quelque chose à rajouter? You want to add something?
Thank you for being with us. I think it's like we'll be doing a month of Mohawk artists like Skewanadi, Angela, and you. And next week we'll have MC Snow.
Okay, excellent.
And just to make sure, Angela is your daughter, right?
No, my niece. My niece.
Your niece, okay.
My niece, yeah, my brother's daughter. Yeah, she's an excellent visual artist and theater performer and writer. And wonderful, for sure.
Okay, I feel like this month is special because we are four marks in a row.
Yeah, yeah. And right now in Ganawagi, they're having it's Ganyakeha, not Rawana Nizra, but it's Cultural Awareness Month. So they have I used to do it when I was there, but they have a month long activities all about culture and history and tradition. Every day of the week, they have several events. So the entire community, if you're in social services or the police station or the elders lodge, you have all these activities to kind of like, it's like a month of tradition. You know, every month of the year is Mohawk days, but you know, this one is the special one. So
yeah,
maybe it's astronomical because there is a story that the peacemaker convince the people to that is a world war true, telling there will be a sign in the sky.
there's a there's I heard that story a long time ago, and there's some historical connections. But right now, again, too, online, you know, there's big controversy. Some people believe it, some people don't believe it. Where's the origins of it? But, you know, I always say, you know, it's like if people are talking about it, it's getting them excited. It's good. You know, it's like, I'm right, you're wrong, you know, kind of deal. But it is, it's a wonderful thing. And I'm sure that was spectacular. I have friends in Buffalo area. It was overcast. It was raining. It was like, said we had it. It was spectacular. At the eastern door of the longhouse, it was spectacular. it was everything and more than it was advertised, you know. So it was a beautiful experience for sure. I really enjoyed it.
No, Niguets.
Oh, no.
Okay, now what y'all go on again.
Right, I'll see you next week.
Watsija.com. Till the next time.
Yes.